All right, we're recording. This is June 20, 1998. We're interviewing Lauro Cruz from originally maybe Houston, maybe somewhere else. But I knew him out of Houston as the first Mexican-American state representative ever out of there a long, long time ago. And you've signed the Need a Gift form, and you know the components of the interview. I forgot to mention that also I'm going to ask you about issues and opinions on certain things. And you asked to start with the beginning, which is genealogy.
Yeah.
Who are the Cruzes, and where did they come from, and when and why?
You know, originally I was born in Beaumont, Texas. But I left there, I'm told, at the tender age of 6 months, so that's not part of my memory bank. Basically, I'm a Houstonian, because I arrived in Houston at the tender age of 6 months, and that's where I lived my life up until I was an adult. The only time I left there was when I was called to active duty in the Marines, the Korean conflict. So, but my family, my father and mother were from this country. They migrated back and forth to Mexico, mostly northern Mexico, Coahuila, Monclova, Coahuila, Mexico, and some of the family was down in Saltillo, but the northern, northwestern part of Mexico. And
now these are parents or grandparents?
My parents. And they came up to San Antonio, and my mother was on the migrant trail up all the way to Georgia back in those years.
What years are these?
Oh, this was the early 90s. I'm having trouble with my voice.
Keep talking, I'll get some water.
Yeah. That was the early years of 1900, the early 1910, 1920, and that's about the time that my mother and father were married. And my father basically has always been an independent person. He always wanted to start the business, and so he started one of his first businesses in Houston, and went from Houston to Beaumont, and then from Beaumont back to Houston, and then from he's had businesses in all these cities, including San Antonio. So he was in the grocery business, the neighborhood grocery business. My dad was. So, basically, I come from a family of six. I have three older sisters and one older brother and one younger brother.
Can we get names on all of these folks?
Sure, absolutely. My oldest sister, her name was Argentina Cruz. And then there was my other sister, Gloria Cruz. Now, my older sister joined the Navy in World War II, the Wave, and she ended up marrying a fellow by the name of Moore. And then my other sister, Gloria, she ended up marrying a fellow by the name of Morales, so she became a Morales. And then my other youngest sister, younger than them, her name is Blanche. She married a fellow by the name of Beltran. Forgot my older brother. My older brother Frank Cruz is basically grew up in Los Talleres as a mechanic, and he grew up and became an airline mechanic. Superhuman being, conservative as you can imagine. Always focused on his job, his life. You know. Beautiful person, one of those people that tithes 10% from the day he got his first job till today to the church, and never was involved in the community. My family is very religious oriented, and they basically are all Lutherans, Missouri Synod Lutherans, very orthodox, the most orthodox Lutherans there are.
How in the world did that happen?
Well, We were in Houston back in the 30s, and a missionary came along and started involving my older sisters and brothers and inviting them to come to church, being part of the church. And after that, you know, I've never known, you know, any other religion other than the Lutheran Church. So then there was my, and I have a younger brother. My younger brother is, se llama Manuel Cruz, and he's graduated from high school, and all of us graduated from high school, but my younger brother graduated from high school, went to the Army and became a cook. And when he got out of the Army, Ralston Purina hired him to cook fish, tuna fish, in big plants. So he ended up making a career out of that. He was in Pango Pango and Puerto Rico and San Diego running tuna plants for Ralston Purina. They packed the chicken of the sea tuna. And funny story related to that, you know, my brother's parece muy mexicano, you know, es el más morenito de la familia. So when he went to Samoa, Pango Pango, he landed, you know, and they always have a big welcome for the new plant manager. So all Samoans were up there, you know, with the waiting for the gate. And so he gets off the plane and he just walks right through them, you know. Nobody else got off the airplane and said, hey, you know, he looked like, they thought he was a Samoan coming
home.
You know? So they said, are you the new plant manager? He said, yeah, I'm the new plant manager. Anyway, he ended up retiring in San Diego and he's still there. Also very involved with the church. My dad ended up having another family with about 10 more kids, and so my mother ended up raising us. My dad left us a house, a business, and a lot of work.
What kind of business?
Well, we had a grocery store and a tortilla factory.
Did you explain why they stopped migrating from Mexico, or did they start in Mexico and end up in Beaumont, or started in Beaumont and end up in Mexico?
No, they started in Mexico. Back in those years, I gather that there was a lot of migration back and forth. People would go to Mexico and try something, they would come back and they would go back, and you know, back in those years there was no immigration points to, you know, you just crossed the border, you know, there were no permits or anything.
Did the Mexican Revolution have anything to do with their ultimate settling out in Beaumont?
No, I think that it was just their lifestyle that ended up doing that. They ended up coming to Houston first. My dad started a grocery store there, and on Congress Avenue, if you can believe it or not, it was sort of the lower end of the downtown section of Houston. And he opened a grocery store. My dad could open a grocery store with a loaf of bread and a roll of bologna. I mean, he really could. He really could. And he did it several times. And but what happened in Houston was they told him, well, you can open that store, but after the sun goes down, we don't want to see you. And so he felt a lot of pressure there. So he moved the family to Beaumont, where there was an opportunity. That was, he opened up a business in Beaumont right in the middle of the Depression. So my family never knew what a depression was. Because at that time, he started a grocery store in the black community in Beaumont, which in that part of the Texas, there's hardly any Hispanics even today, and much less back in those years, in the early 30s and late 20s. So he opened up a grocery store in the black community, and he had a bakery, a liquor store, and a grocery store. And he did well. And for whatever reasons, by 1933, he decided to go back to Houston. And again, he started another grocery store, and that was what he did. He, as I said, he could start a business with on a string of any kind. Mm-hmm. So,
did we get names of your dad and your mom?
Yeah, my mother's name was Margarita Menchaca, and my dad's name was Manuel Cruz.
And Margarita was from where?
She originally always claimed to be from Uvalde.
Uvalde?
Yeah.
That's in Texas?
Yeah.
Not in Mexico?
Not in Mexico.
And your dad?
And my dad, from as near as I can tell, he was born in San Antonio.
Uh-huh.
And my grandmother, my grandparents were from Mexico.
Ah, okay.
And my grandmother's name was Lina Cardenas.
On your dad's side?
On my dad's side.
Right.
Yeah. And
did you ever meet the grandparents on the mom's side?
Yes, I met my grandmother. I never met my grandfather. You know, those records were, who knows, very nebulous, very.
Yeah.
But my grandmother, you know, it was very funny how my mother ended up marrying my father, you know. Strange how these things happen, but those are customs and things. Back then, you just didn't do these things. What happened was that my mother stopped to talk to my father, and she was unescorted, and her brothers and her mother said, "You have to marry that man, and you're out of this house. You were seen talking to a man on the street." And so my grandmother took my mother in, because she was thrown out of the house because of this business of, well, you're seen talking to a person, you by yourself, it's a male, and that was just, you don't do those things. And so my mother made that mistake, and so they threw her out. My mother took her in, and shortly after that, she married my father. Interesting way of the cultures were back in those days.
Wow. Okay. Well, can we talk about your family, your children, so we get the genealogy out of the way?
Sure, absolutely. I got married in 1955. Been married to the same lady ever since. I think, 43, 44 years. And I have my oldest son. His name is Chris. And he went to law school, went to UT, then went to law school in Houston, and ended up in California. He migrated, love carried him to West, and then he moved to Salt Lake City, and now he got out of the business, the law business, and has gone, he's now working as a computer executive with a firm called Travelware. And it's the computer world, you know, and he's doing quite well. And then my oldest daughter, she's here in Austin, and she's also a UT graduate. And no, I take that back. She needs 20 hours to graduate, and she'll never do it because she just won't do it. You know, she's been out of school 10 years. She won't go back and take 20 hours to get her degree. So she's a physical trainer. She has a business out at Lakeway. And then there's my youngest son, who's an Aggie. He graduated 6 months after, or one semester after his wife, who was an architect, both Aggies. They packed up and went to Seattle. Blind, not knowing that they had a job or not. They just researched it, said this is the best place to find a job according to the research they had done. And they just packed up and moved there. And she works as an architect there, and he works as he got a degree in business computers. He works for Boeing. Been with them for about 15 years. And my youngest daughter, she's a UT graduate in fashion design. And she is the only daughter that, or only child that has produced a grandson. We have a grandson. His name is Luke, and she lives here in Austin. And she was married. She was married to a dentist, and now she's doing work on her own. She has her own business.
Can we give names to these people?
Yeah,
we got Luke and we got Chris. Yeah, not your wife.
My oldest,
the other.
Yeah, my oldest is Chris. And then my second daughter is Camille, and then my youngest son is Jerry Cruz, and then my youngest daughter is Catherine Stanny Cruz.
Catherine what?
Stanny. That's a Czech name.
Spell it.
Stanninie.
Does it mean something?
Well, it's probably a derivative of Stanislava. You know, they shortened those names. This is Czech immigrants.
Where'd you get that inspiration to put that as her middle name?
Oh, that's her. That was her grandmother's name. That was her grandmother's name, Stanny. They reduced her grandmother's name down to Stanny from Stanislava, and then so we just named her after her grandmother on my wife's side. And my wife's her name is Clarice, and she's Czech, basically, and her grandparents were all immigrants. They came over to this country, landed in Galveston on a sailboat in the late 1850s, right before the Civil War. And they all settled around Brenham, in that area. And basically that covers the...
Well, where did you meet your wife?
Oh, my wife. I met my wife at the University of Houston. She was a student and I was a student. And we just hit it off and probably married a little bit early. You know, at that time I was going to the University of Houston and driving a bus part-time. Somebody asked me, ABC, I was being interviewed on the telephone by ABC, and they were saying, what do you consider one of your, you know, some of your greater accomplishments? And they were amazed at my answer, and but it was a fact. I said, well, one of the things that I consider a great accomplishment is I became a bus driver. And they said, bus driver? I said, yeah, a city bus. I said, I came back from the Marines in 1954, and I was looking for a job, and so I went and applied for a job with the Houston Transit, and they never had hired a Mexican to drive a bus. And there was a lot of resistance, you know, sort of, just to be honest with you, this redneck attitude, they just felt like, you know, we don't hire Mexicans. That was it. Well, I applied, and while they accepted my application, they did everything that they could to bus me on training, and they didn't managed to do that, and so I became the first Mexican-American to drive a bus. I mean, and, you know, it's odd because, you know, people would get on the bus, and I was driving, you know, and they had this huge mirror at the top of the bus, you know, about 24 inches wide, and the Mexicanos would get on the bus, you know, they'd drop their coins in the coin counter. And I could see them going back, and they'd turn around, and I could hear them whispering, "Hey, parece Mexicano," you know. And it's crazy, but you know that's the way things were, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was, and of course now you know, it's so ridiculous now because everybody drives buses today. Today women drive buses, black, anybody wants a job driving a bus. But back in those days, it was a big deal to be the first a Mexicano in driving a bus. As ridiculous as that may sound.
You said that all your brothers and sisters finished high school. That was impressive, particularly at the time, and then the number of brothers and sisters. Who instilled that in all of you, mother or father or both?
Mostly,
and then take us through your educational experience.
Yeah, mostly my mother. She pushed hard for us to get an education. And of course, high school was the plateau there back in those days, you know. That was the thing you shot for, you know, and so I was a junior in high school when the Korean War started, and they activated us. So I ended up going into active service in the Marine Corps without a high school diploma. So what I did is I got a GED in the Marine Corps while I was serving, and I came back, and I knew that I wanted to go on to school. Now, I'm the only college graduate in my family. Everybody else, that was their plateau, and that's all they wanted, I guess. I came back from the Marine Corps, wanted to go to college, and the problem was I didn't know how to enroll. I just went over to the University of Houston, and I said, how do I get in here, you know? Somebody said, you go to the admissions office. I said, okay, well, anyway, I ended up there. I was probably the poorest student you ever looked at in your life. I mean, I probably had the worst study habits. It was because of my early upbringing. See, when parents separate, that creates a crisis. And I was in that crisis at that age where, I mean, I was out shining shoes till 3 a.m, selling newspapers and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so, you know, andas en la calle, you know lo que aprendes en la calle, you know, with us. You know, you could live a whole lifetime without all that experience. But it was there, and I did it. And so about 98% of the people I grew up with ended up in prison. And, you know, there, but for the grace of God, go I. You know, I just, my mother, I guess, instilling us in the church and school. And but in my other hours, I was out, you know, in the barrio, messing around with the guys, you know. So I probably had, and I'm almost a self-trained person. I mean, I was a voracious
reader.
Reader. I mean, by the time I was in the seventh grade, I would go to the library and read Time magazine cover to cover. Just liked it. Just wanted to read it. But when somebody wanted me to perform in school, I wouldn't perform.
You like to read, or you like to know?
Read. Apparently, whatever it was, I liked to read. Because whatever I was getting out of it, I liked. And so, you know, you get sort of left out there, and you know, your mother's running a business. You look back and you understand these things, but at the time it's happening, it's just happening to you. Your mother's running a business. There's only one parent there. Everybody's busy. You know, brothers and sisters go off to World War II. You're left there to do things. It was my life has been an incredible mixture of it's almost traumatic to think about myself growing up in that situation, because, you know, I had responsibility, but when I wasn't performing that responsibility, I was out loose, fancy free, you know. My job in the store was to, on Saturday morning, to go out and buy supplies. So by the age of 12, I was driving a Model A. My brothers and sisters had gone into the service, so that left me at 12 years old responsible for buying for the store. So I would get in my Model A and about 5 in the morning, go to the farmer's market and buy cases of tomatoes, sacks, 100-pound sacks of potatoes, cabbage, lettuce, grapes, you know. Sometimes I'd make 2 trips to back to the store. And then I was trying to be active in school, and the coach, I wanted to play football, and of course said, we're going to have practice on Saturday. So I can't be here on Saturday. I got to go buy groceries. I mean, you know, they didn't understand why I could not be there for practice. But I had to go buy. Then after I got all the produce, I'd have to unload all that and then go back and buy quarters of meat, you know, a quarter cow or half a cow. And I'd sit there and select the meat and select all the merchandise and then load that up, carry it back. And then after I got all the purchasing done, then I was free. Free to go roam the streets. Roaming the streets. In Houston, back there, I grew up in the First Ward, the Sixth Ward, some in Second Ward. So, you know, in the streets, it's just the streets. What can I say? You know, there's not a lot of good things you can learn in the streets. I'll tell you one thing you don't learn. You don't get good study habits there. So, everything I have always done, if I'm interested, I'll do it. And if I'm not interested, you know, I may go through the motions, but I won't do it. You know, that's just a strange thing. The background gives it, you know, gives you that kind of, whatever it is instilled in you by that kind of experience. So I went on to the university and got a degree there, and I went to law school at South Texas College of Law. And I have a Doctor of Laws. That's an honorary degree from the International Houston University, you know, the school that Leonel Castillo and that bunch started over there. And I have a lot of I guess you call it executive training, University of Texas, and basically that's my background.
Any significant experiences in the Korean conflict, or any significant experiences in high school? I guess you never played football then.
Oh, I played football and ran track until I went to the Marines.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or at the South Texas College of Law, you must have been either the first or among the first. There must not have been many other Mexicans there at the time.
By the time I got to the law school, it was in the late 50s, and so there had been a few Mexicanos through law school there. Not a bunch, but a few.
Do you remember some of the ones that went to school here?
The people that were there before with me, I don't know if you know Martinez, practiced law there, I can't remember his first name anymore. Abe Ramirez was there a little bit before I was there. The people that when I was growing up, there was only one Mexicano that was an attorney in Houston, John J. Herrera. And after him came ¿cómo se llama? Hernández, José Hernández. And after that came Felix Fraga. No, excuse me, Felix Salazar, and then after that it was as people begin to see success and experience, they're drawn to what is the possible,
Mm-hmm. Nothing out of Korea.
Well, that was just the Marines in Korea, that.
Now, did you enlist, or were you drafted and put into the Marines?
I volunteered for the Marine Corps Reserve, and that's why I was called up, and they were exempting seniors, but not juniors, so I had to go. And it was one of those things, you have to go, you have to go.
Well, how did you get into politics?
Well, when I came back
from Korea,
I worked at different odd jobs, a bus company, finance companies, the small loan companies. That was still the days when things were tough, I went and applied for that job as a small loan, they call them sharks. I went and applied for that job, and knowing how things were, and they had this ad in the paper, I was there at 7 o'clock. The place opened at 8. I wanted to be the first one in line. So I got in line at 7 in the morning, and then the line built up over a period of time. Then we opened the doors. They gave everybody an application, and I had already some college behind me. And so everybody filled out their application, and about 11 o'clock, after everybody had been called upstairs for an interview, I'm still waiting there. And finally, the boss, the owner of the place, came down the stairs. This was downtown Houston. And he says, "Is that all of them?" And the lady, the manager there, she says, "Oh," she said, "no, here's still one more." That was me.
Oh, man, here you were, the first one.
The first one.
She forgot to turn that one in.
Yeah. Then he looks right there as he's standing. He looks at my application. He says, "When can you go to work?" And I said, "I can go to work this afternoon if you want me to." He says, "Fine, be here in the morning at 8 o'clock. But you see how things were? They were just ridiculous, anyway, after that, I was already married by then. And I had a natural gravitation towards what kind of business? The grocery business, right? I mean, that's what I had known all my life. So I went into business with my dad, and with a little stake, and that lasted about a month. And even my dad realized that wasn't going to work. And so he said, "We found another business that was for sale." So I borrowed, I got $500 from my dad, which was my stake in his business, and I borrowed $800 more, and I made a deal to buy this store. And this guy wanted to get out of the business, so the rest I signed for. I paid for that business in 1 year, and was going to school at the same time, and raising a family. So while I was there,
where was that store?
That was on the 6th Ward in the barrio, right downtown.
You know, I don't know my wards in Houston.
You know where the police station is in Houston? The administration building. It's just 6th Ward is just one block off Memorial Drive, and where Memorial Drive meets Houston Avenue.
Okay.
Does that help? You know where the Coliseum is?
Yeah.
It's about 6 blocks from there.
Okay.
Right downtown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's where the business was. This was barrio. And I was there for several years, and I used to always vote. You know, I just voted religiously, you know. By the way, I had my degree, my undergraduate degree was in political science. But I noticed that there was this lady where I voted who was an Anglo. And I didn't understand that, because by this time 95% of the community was Hispanic or Mexican American. And so I decided to run for that precinct judge job, and I guess I overdid it in a way, but you know, I guess she accused me of thinking that I was running for president, you know, because what I did is I borrowed a lady's front porch right across from the fire station where the precinct was, where the voting precinct was, and this was a porch that ran across about maybe 50 feet, and I took butcher paper and ran my name all the way across the top, you know, to vote for me, and I beat her pretty bad, and I don't know if you remember Frankie Randolph.
I know the name.
She was the mother of, she was on the National Democratic Committee, and she was the mother of liberal politics in Texas. Anyway, I beat her, and then I got involved in what was called the Harris County Democrats, which was made up of mostly precinct judges. And Frankie Randolph, I got back to the grocery store about 9:30 that night, and I was in the grocery store, and I had a payphone there, and the phone rang. That was an odd hour for the phone to be ringing inside my business, you know, and so I picked up the phone, and it was Frankie Randolph. I mean, this lady, she's a multimillionaire, you know, inherited that big logging or business out of East Texas, and she was about 75, 80 years old. She had a gravelly voice, and she says,
"Is this Laurel Cruz?"
I says, "Yes, it is."
He says, "This is Frankie Randolph."
He says,
"You did a good job, boy. You did a good job."
And I tell you what, I found out later on that when she said, "You did a good, you're a good boy, and you did a good job," that was the highest accolade she paid anybody. Whether you were the president of the United States or, you know, the janitor, and I had heard of her, you know, everybody had heard of her in liberal politics, and I was extremely gratified to know that here this lady had taken the time to call me to tell me I had done a great job, you know.
So you did this by yourself?
I did that by myself.
Okay.
Yeah. I was not when I had announced to run for that precinct job, the people from Paso came over to talk to me.
Who was that at that time?
Roy Elizondo, David Ortiz, and David was the one that came over. And he said, "We want to endorse you for a precinct judge." I said, "Fine, you know, that's no problem. What are you going to do for me?" He said, "We'll pass cards out for you." I said, "Fine." And I appreciated that. You know, you appreciate any kind of support you can get. And After I won that race, I became more involved in the political process. And it was almost impossible for Mexicano to get elected in Houston because at that time he ran countywide. And it was too expensive and it was just prohibitive.
Let me just clarify this though. Mm-hmm. Now, did you file to become the precinct chair, committee person, or just the election night precinct judge that you just do on election night?
What happened is for the precinct judge, that was on the ballot. Okay. To be the precinct committeeman, I think I've got these properly separated. There was an election after the polls closed. Mm-hmm. And what I did,
that's what you're talking about.
No, I won the judgeship.
The thing on the ballot.
After the convention, I also won that too.
All right, so you actually filed with the Democratic Party and ran a regular campaign and then took over the convention as well.
And at the convention, I had gotten a fellow by the name of Paul Valdez, who was a very good friend of mine. I said, Paul, you know, I'm trying to make this as simple as possible. Now, most of the time, maybe 10, 12 people show up at a precinct convention. And I had about 60 people there. Okay, and this lady was very upset. I mean, she just really was upset, this Anglo lady. She was a nice person. She just didn't belong there. I mean, it was the wrong, she represented the wrong group of people, and she was voting wrong, too. So, because at that time, the Houston was pretty much divided liberal and conservative under the Democratic Party, you know, and they had these big fights, you know, going to the county conventions and, you know, getting your delegates stolen from you and all that stuff was going on. Anyway, I asked Paul Valdez to wear a red shirt. I said, Paul, I'm going to, just to make, when we call for the vote, I'm going to ask for a division of the House, and you go tell all of us to
follow the red shirt.
So when I moved for a division of the House, he moved over to one side and everybody moved over there. She had nobody, she had three people there. And so it was over with, yeah. And so that's the skinny on what happened in the precinct. Then that got me more involved politically at the county level, and still was prohibitive. Bill Kilgarland had gotten elected. You know, he was liberal. He got elected and defeated in one term. He was up here in Austin for 2 years, and then he got beat. Everybody was. And there had been other candidates, Mexicanos, running for different slots, but they couldn't. They got nowhere.
Now, what year was this?
This was in 1966, the year of the election.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, weren't you already involved in the Farm Worker March by then?
That was the year that we became involved in the farm.
Okay.
The farm workers. Well, I'll tell you about that in a minute. But you know, what happened is that in 1965. They were getting a lot of pressure for single member districts or some kind of districts that would be more one man, one vote. And so the legislature divided the county into three multi-member districts. There were three multi-member districts. There were 19 members in all, but each district had six people, and seven people. So it was divided into a tri-county area. So then it became possible to win. I was running in the northeast end of the city, or the county, which was it still had about 560,000 people. So it was still a pretty big district, but it was feasible because now you had a lot of the blacks, a lot of the Mexicanos, and a lot of the industrial workers in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of divided the conservatives and gave liberals a chance to win. So what we did after that there was resistance even in the liberal ranks, because here was this opportunity for blacks to get elected, for a Mexicano to get elected. And here's what happened. I was not really ready to run for office at that time, because I felt like I needed to you know, get more things done, financially and otherwise. But because of my activity, now my activity in the Democratic Party at the time was, mine and what other Mankinis were involved was very limited. We had about three or four people involved, three or four, five at the most. And you're talking about a room full of Democrats with something like 700 people, you know? So, anyway, I decided that I didn't want to run, and the liberal said to me, basically, if you run, we'll endorse you, but we don't know anybody else that will endorse. So I said, well, I guess I'll have to run then, because if I'm the only Mankini you're going to endorse, because I had been active. So I ran, and then the coalition met. The coalition leaders met to endorse the candidates that they were going to endorse. And there was one individual there. I don't know whether he had a loss of memory or maybe excitement or whatever. But they voted. And they voted to endorse, in that district, six people. One black and one Jewish person and four other people. Well, obviously there had been more people that wanted to be endorsed by this coalition, and the guy that was heading it up, sort of chairing it, he was an attorney there by the name of Chris Dixie. They kept, you know, counting the vote. I mean, who's been endorsed, who hasn't been endorsed? And Roy Lisondo was in there on the committee, they'd say, okay, these are the people that we endorsed. This person, this person, this person, this person, this person, and this person. And Roy Lisondo would say, hey, Lauro Cruz, we endorse Lauro Cruz. Oh, yeah, Lauro Cruz, okay. Okay, and then they'd argue, talk some more, and then they'd say, okay, the chairman of the thing, he'd say, okay, these are the people who endorse, this person, and then Roy said, hey, look, we endorse Lauro Cruz too. Three times. And this was a coalition of labor, blacks, and Mexicanos. And so...
Now, no liberals?
Yeah, liberals also. Excuse me, did I leave them out?
Well, you said labor, but
yeah,
liberals,
yeah, labor,
are another category.
There were some liberals there too. And so, finally, they concluded who they were going to endorse, and he comes out to announce. All the candidates are waiting outside because we were interviewed then. Told to wait outside. He comes out there and he says, and we're all anxiously waiting. And he says, this person, this person, this person, this person, and this person. He counts five. And I said, wait, that's five. This is the same person. He says, oh, yeah, you also. And, you know, is that a lapse of memory? Or apparently, I think he probably had somebody else in mind. They still did not believe. This was the same district that elected Barbara Jordan as for the Senate seat, and Curtis Graves, the black state representative.
But Curtis preceded Barbara. Curtis was the one that got endorsed when you got endorsed, no?
We all got endorsed at the same time.
Well, even Barbara? So they had two blacks?
Two blacks, one in the Senate, one in the House, and one Mankino as a state rep.
Okay.
So, anyway, even right down to that last, you know, whether it was a lapse of memory or that he didn't think he could win, or whether he was committed to somebody else or whatever, but there was that we had to cope with.
Did you know how much money you were going to lose by winning that election?
No, and I had no idea. I had no idea.
Okay. How did you campaign? How did you raise the money, or did the coalition do it all?
No, the coalition was very effective. Everybody that the coalition endorsed got elected. I was the only, I drew five opponents because they felt like a black could get elected because the blacks voted in large numbers and the other folks could get elected. But they still didn't think, there were some folks out there who were making their application for the candidacy, but in the party that were not endorsed, but I drew four opponents.
Who were they, do you remember?
There was one guy ended up in a runoff with him by the name of Bill Rice. And then there was a Jewish fellow who apologized for after that he had put his name on the ballot. In fact, he caused me to be in the runoff. I gathered a little over 47% of the vote in the primary. And everybody else got elected. Everybody else. Barbara, Curtis Graves, Rex Braun, Joe Allen, Glenn Vickery, everybody else got in without a runoff. Except me, because I drew four opponents. And the one guy, even though he was publicly withdrew, his name was still on the ballot, and that was enough to force me into a runoff. And of course, everybody was saying at that point, you see, we told you that Americano, now that the Anglo has got him 1-1, he'll beat him. Well, he didn't beat me. I really just ran over him, really.
So did you do something different in the runoff? I mean, it sounded like you kind of relied on the coalition at the primary.
Right.
But in the runoff, did you go out there and do your thing?
Oh, even with the coalition.
Put your paper all over the Sixth Ward or Northeast Harris?
Yeah, it's a big area. One third of Harris County is a big area. I think that I had the coalition's help in the primary, and in the runoff, I didn't have as much help, but that did not reduce my enthusiasm as I was out there working as hard with and without their support. And labor had a lot of stroke in that area. You know, those people are pretty well organized. The only thing that I was counting on and hoping I could successfully get out was the black vote and the Hispanic vote. I assumed that whatever Hispanic vote I got out would vote for me, but I needed to somehow get the black vote out because they voted in greater numbers, and I wasn't sure they were going to come out for me, you know. And without a black on the ballot, you know, that makes it a little more difficult. But as it turned out, the papers, the Houston Chronicle, one of the major papers in Houston, endorsed my opponent. They also thought that once Mexicano got into a runoff, that was as far as he could go. Mm-hmm. So things did change after that.
So did Barbara and Curtis help you, or you just became acquainted with them in the process?
Well,
and you weren't friends?
No, Barbara Jordan and I worked for the same foundation called Wide Horizons. We were working together when we first filed for office.
I thought you were in the grocery store.
No, I had left the business already. I sold the business in about 1963 or 64, and then I got involved. I was the campaign co-chairman for the Humphrey Johnson campaign, and right in there I sold the store and went to work for an agency for about a year. And then when I get ready to run for office, because they were federally funded, they felt a little nervous about it, even though I was campaigning, you know, after work. Then I went and to work for this foundation, which Barbara went to work with, too. It was just starting out. It was Barbara Jordan, myself, and another black fellow by the name of Otis King, who later became the dean of the law school at Texas Southern. I think he still teaches there.
So did she help you get up the black vote, or
no?
Or you found somebody else?
No. You know, in a runoff, you know, even your best friends, they just go off to do something else. Curtis went to New Orleans to celebrate his victory. You know, he was from New Orleans. I just, you know, with a little help from the coalition and mostly myself in the runoff, that was it, you know. Okay.
So here comes a rude awakening.
Yeah.
Who else was in the legislature at the time? Must have been just a few guys from the valley. Maybe Bob Vail from San Antonio, Paul Moreno from El Paso, Tati Santisteo from El Paso. That's about it, no?
Yeah.
Nobody from Austin.
Honoré Legarre from Laredo.
Right, yeah, the guys from the valley, that South Texas.
Yeah, you know, that was an interesting period because it was the end of the period where the Mexicanos that were holding office down there were no longer beginning to be elected by the big ranchers. or not elected, but nominated, and that was tantamount to being elected. And if you were Mexicano, right there at that cutting point there and back, if you were Mexicano and you were serving in Austin, you had been appointed by the big ranchers. I mean, they had given you their blessings or you wouldn't be up there. It had, you were an Anglo otherwise. But that was beginning. That was the point where the people were getting more say about.
Yeah, and the vote Mexicans.
Yeah,
yeah.
They the
couldn't
tax.
Buy and vote Mexicans. Exactly. Dead or alive.
Yeah. So, but up until that time, we still had a few people that were pretty much, you know, the choice of the big ranchers down there and the big farmers. Down from Raúl Longoria was there. From Benavides, Oscar Carrillo, from Brownsville, Henry Sanchez.
Probably had one of the Canales, no?
Terry Canales came later.
Wasn't there one before?
Yeah, there was one before, yeah. Well, these folks, we know they knew their limitations.
And no Mexicano senator.
Yeah, nobody in the legislature would rally the raza in the house. They very competent people. They just wouldn't do it. I mean, I did it, and they would not refuse to do it, but they wouldn't take the lead. I'd say, come on, let's have a meeting over here, you know, and we, you know, have our little caucus meetings in the corner. There's only 10 of us, and we'd meet in the corner, but it would be on my initiative, even though I was not the senior member there, but they wouldn't do it, you know. They were not cause-oriented, you know, it was the political thing, you know, even though, I didn't even know that Henry Sanchez could speak Spanish, you know, and he was from Cameron County. And Raúl Longoria, you know, kind of voted conservative, you know, but now if you ask them, to come, if you presented the issue, you know, the proposed legislation, and it was pro-raza, they would vote. I mean, they would not vote against it, you know. But they wouldn't move too much to get it done. You know.
Now, did you adopt the coalition's liberal philosophy, or you simply had that as a counter already to your conservative family members, or how did that come to be that you started championing these Chicano causes?
Well, my most of my family is very conservative. For whatever reason, maybe it was the barrio, the running in the streets, or whatever, the misery, and I felt, you know, I have always felt Mexicano, you know, and my family doesn't. My family, they're just good people. But and they're not cause oriented. Whatever it is, I don't know. But they never, you know, they were good Christian people. They would, you know, do within the confines of whatever organized religions do good. They would do good, and they were good people. But to say almost like de la raza, you know, they just never occurred to them. Never, it was not part of their thinking. How it got into my mind, the only thing I can attribute it to was just running the streets in the barrio, you know. What else could it be? I don't know.
Mm. Okay. All right. So, how could you stay alive after you got the first paycheck and had to move to Austin? Who'd you live with?
I had some money. I'd made some money in the grocery business. And from 1966, the money I had made in the grocery business slowly disappeared. In 1972, that was when I realized that my kids were getting older. I couldn't afford that luxury anymore. I mean, I loved the process. I had dominated the process. Most of the legislation that I passed was controversial legislation, minimum wage, farm worker legislation, housing for transportation for migrants, and it was all controversial legislation, and I managed to pass it. I never introduced a bill like that I didn't eventually pass. And so I mastered the system, but I couldn't afford it. My kids were growing up. I had to do something. I had to move up or move out. And that's when I ran for state treasurer in 1972.
Well, before you get there, tell me how you managed to with only 10 sure votes,
Let me tell you about...
Get anything done.
The marcha, because a lot of people, okay. You know... In 1966, after the runoff, we had a headquarters in Magnolia, right across from the Catholic Church there, the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And somebody had a little storefront there that had been converted from a house. At one time it had been a Mexican bakery. Anyway, after the election, we had celebrated. It was about 1-2 in the morning. Things were dying down. And John Castillo, who is now a city council member, and some other guys who were helping me in the campaign, said, "Hey, Lotto, we want to talk to you about some abuse that's going on in Rio Grande City with the farm workers." And I said, "Oh, man." I said, "Man, it's 2 in the morning." I said, "Okay, let's have a quick committee meeting and talk about it, and then let's just call it a day." So we had a quick committee meeting in the back room there, and they were talking about how they had some appeals for help, that the rangers were mistreating the farm workers down there. And so we decided, okay, let's do this. Let's send a committee down there from Houston to drive down to Rio Grande City and find out what's going on. Okay, that's what we concluded that night. It was now 3 in the morning, and we needed to go, you know. So the next day, some of those guys got in a car. It was a Saturday night. They got in the car the next day and they drove to Rio Grande City. They had to do it on the weekend because, you know, everybody worked. So they went down there and they checked it out and, you know, they met with Gene Nelson. And they came back and they said, "Man, it's bad down there. Man, those people are just scared to death." So then they said, "Well, let's, you know," they sent another, a car load of guys down there to Rio Grande, and there was some more talk about what can we do to help and so forth. That's a long ways from Rio Grande City to Houston, but it was being done. I had a Jewish fellow by the name of Walter Katz that was very helpful. Walter Katz and I and Barbara Jordan had worked together in White Horizons, and that's how he became part of our group. So they went down there again, and they said, "Well, maybe we could, you know, do something, you know, to take food or whatever." So about the third trip down there, I went down there. I was the state representative elect at that time.
No Republican opponent.
No. It was tantamount to being
back then. It was one party dominance, Democrats.
One party dominance, and you got elected. So I was in effect the party. Anyway, we went down there, and we drove into Rio Grande City, and there was Gene Nelson. Eugene Nelson with him. And he was crossing the street, and he waved at us, and so they already knew him, so we stopped over and talked for a while and everything, and we were trying to figure out what we knew to help these guys, you know. So anyway, it was decided that what we would do, there was Father Gonzalez, used to be, you know, that church that I mentioned that was across from my headquarters. He was the one of the priests there, and so they got him involved. Antonio Gonzalez. We got him involved in the march, and there was another very active Baptist minister by the name of James Navarro. We got him involved, and so we were down there, and it was decided to demonstrate we were going to march from Rio Grande City to San Juan. And we marched to San Juan. And man, you know, let me tell you, I was tired. We marched to San Juan, we got to San Juan, and everybody packed into this room. It wasn't in the church, it was in a room there, sort of a recreation room or something. And I was tired. It was so full of people, and I said, "I'm going to wait out here. You know, Father Gonzalez is going to sit there and rave and, you know, raise Cain about how he's doing this and doing that. And then Reverend Navarro, if you don't let him talk, you let him pray, he'd get his speech in, you know." Got to rest his soul. Anyway, I'm sitting out by the window. I'm just tired, leaning up against the window, listening to what's going on inside. And Father Gonzalez, I'm sitting there with blistered feet, just walking from Rio Grande City. And he's sitting there, "Oh, he wants que la justicia y que la raza y que el poder de la gente," you know, all that stuff, you know. And I'm sitting there listening, you know. And he says, "Y vamos a marchar desde aquí hasta Austin." And man, now my heart almost dropped. Like, what in the heck is he talking about? He's going to march all the way to Austin. And well, we know once he made that big statement, what we were going to do, well, you're committed, right? So
The march route got accidentally in a moment of emotion?
Yeah. It was like, you know, Father Gonzalez just said, this is what we're going to demonstrate. We're going to march to Austin now. So that's how the marcha got started to Austin. And what we were doing in Houston with David and John Castillo and a whole bunch of David, Dali Ortiz, and a bunch of people, we were...
Did you say Idalia or Dali?
Dali Ortiz.
Dalio.
Dali. Dali.
Is that a female?
Yeah, female.
Like a doll Dali?
Yeah.
Okay.
Colored Dalis. That was David Ortiz's wife.
Okay.
And so...
Now, all these people are Paso members. Are you involved with the Paso chapter there?
Oh, yeah. I was involved with the Paso.
Well, Paso goes all the way back to 60.
Yeah.
So when did you hook up with them? When you ran for precinct chair?
When I ran for precinct chair is when I hooked up with them.
And you stayed with them after that?
Yeah.
Did you go to Crystal City in 63?
Yeah.
Ah,
well, no, not Crystal City. I went to Del Rio.
That's 68.
That's later. Yeah, that's later.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the farm worker strike is the first one when you venture out of Houston and go do something on the statewide basis.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. So we went, we came back to Houston, and you know what needed was food, supplies to keep the farm worker, money, raising money. And I would join the march, you know, off and on. They marched up from San Juan up through Edinburgh, and then from Edinburgh up to San Antonio. And then I joined them in San Antonio again. And then from San Antonio, I joined them in New Brunswick.
Oh, were you there for the confrontation?
For the confrontation, yeah.
Well, tell me your version.
Well. my version was simply that John Connolly, you know, it was funny, you know, because John Connolly, a lot of people may not see it my way, but I thought he was a little pompous, you know, and it's like we were below him, you know. I'm the governor, I set up the meeting, you come when I say, and you got... we ended up with about 22,000 people there, and they was in the papers. It was a major march for that time, and so he should have picked up on that. And we had asked him, when I say we, as you know, Father Gonzalez and Reverend Navarro, and we weren't getting much labor support at that time. And so he decided, he asked Ben Barn to come with him to meet the marchers in New Brunswick, and he asked Preston Smith, and Preston Smith said, they don't want to see me, they want to see you, you know. They weren't asking for you. But Ben Barn, you know, he was his protege, so he came down here. And it was so funny because...
Wasn't Wagner Carr involved too?
I don't remember Wagner Carr being involved.
Okay.
He might have been there. Anyway, when he came up to talk to Father Gonzalez, Father Gonzalez shoved a cross in his face, you know? And his reaction was, well, it wasn't the cross, but it was something being thrust in his face. And to me, what it reminded me of is, you know, when in the vampire movies, where somebody thrusts a cross and the vampire backs off, you know? And this is where they caught him in a picture. They caught him in a picture where he was backing off from the cross, you know? And it was the exact reaction that you would get in a vampire movie. You know? Anyway, he came there, and you know, he made his little pitch that you know, he was gonna do this and that, and he would not meet us at the Capitol, and that they anyway. After that, we went on to the University of St. Edward's. That's where our next stop was, at St. Edward's University. At that point is when labor took over. They had the money. They were providing the facilities and the food, and they kind of just took over. which wasn't a big deal, but it really kind of like they should have let, you know, our people continue to take more of the lead, not just start telling us, you know, well, no, this guy will speak, that guy will speak. And
But hasn't it been that way? And while this coalition on a statewide basis held, labor has always said what's best for Mexicans.
Yeah.
And their labor leaders that are Mexican-American are the ones that take the lead.
Yeah.
The Pancho Medranos, the Paul Montemayor, and so on.
I think that, I was talking to a labor leader one time, and these are good people, but I understand how it is, and they don't seem to want to admit it. Maybe they do more today than they did then, but I would say to them, I said, you know, my commitment is to my people. Your commitment is to our people too, but first to labor. And they didn't like that. You know, but that's true. They had to, if they wanted to continue working and drawing a salary from labor, they have to make their first priority the labor movement and then the raza, and then the mecano, because that's just the way, that's called the bread and butter end of business. And labor could have taken a different position and given them more freedom, but that's just the way it works. You know?
Okay, well, before the March story, I had asked you, how did you craft the votes? How did you get things out of committee? With only 10 folks that were your sure vote, how in the world did you do this? Very conservative Democrats.
The first year I was a freshman there, I came up here to change the world, to be honest with you. I came up here, I'm an ex-Marine, I'm an American citizen, we're going to push through. And what I hit is a brick wall. And that's the system. And when I backed off after the first season, after zero batting average, I said, well, wait a minute. I reassessed this thing. I said, no, that's how this thing works. Okay. So I said, well, just because I'm a Mexicano and because I'm a liberal, that doesn't mean I'm stupid and that they have all the brains. I can do, this is a one-on-one kind of thing. I'll give you an example. I had one guy that was from Dallas, and he was not ever going to vote for minimum wage. And I would approach him every day, and I'd say, John, I said, are you going to vote for minimum wage? This is my second term. So you going to vote for minimum wage? He said, get out of here, you know. And every day I would approach him that way. And that year it so happened that the big issue of liquor by the drink was up. Had been up many times, but, one more time. I had always failed. So one morning I went through my ritual, hey, John, you going to vote on minimum wage? And I ritually turned away and started to walk away, which is, I knew he was going to say, get out of here, And he says, well, and I stopped. I said, well, what? He says, well, how are you going to vote on liquor by the drink? And I said, well, I really don't know about that, He said, well, if you can vote for liquor by the, he was from Dallas. He said, if you can vote for liquor by the drink, I might be, can vote for, give you a vote on minimum wage. And I said, well, let me think about it, John. Why, my God, if I voted against liquor by the drink in Houston, I'd have been shot, But I said, let me think about it. So I came back after, I said, you know what, John, you got a deal. Let's do it. So that's how you get those votes, one at a time. And the other thing is, Mexicanos in the past, up until that point, there was something about the way they dealt with the Anglo people. A little bit on the subservient side. And I never approached it that way. I approached it as an equal. You can be conservative or you can be whatever you want to be, but otherwise, you're a man, I'm a man. We have opinions, you have opinions, and there's not going to be an unlevel playing field, psychologically anyway. And so you just work these people. You find out they're human beings, and you can't get a lot of people to get off that conservative kick with a shotgun. No way you're going to do it. But other people, after a while, you massage them, you vote here, vote there, you can sign up. You can't give them what they want, but there are other ways to work the psychology, the overall system, and you build up enough vote to get it passed. And during that first session, the other thing was that I tacked on an amendment for a minimum wage on a bill that was totally, not totally unrelated, but it was unrelated to minimum wage, but I tacked on an amendment and forced a vote. Ben Barnes led it up on the board like a flash, Well, the flash was 69 votes. So there were a lot of people that say, well, you know, a lot of people are talking a big game about being against minimum wage, but somewhere this guy's come up with 69 votes. He's not that far away from 76. So I got that on a motion to get a record vote. And he, even though that record vote was a flash, I mean, he didn't leave it up there. I mean, it was like a stoplight, you know. You know, usually they'll run up the vote and leave it there. But this one went... But it was a record still there. Anyway, that kind of encouraged people the second time around because they said, hey, well, you know, there are a lot of people over here. Just not, this is not just some wild aberration, you know. So you've been building it up like that, you know, and working it and working it, working the system.
And the committees, because before it gets on the floor, you got to get those things out of the committee.
Yeah.
And those are unfriendly committees.
Unfriendly committees.
And you probably didn't have a lot to trade. You were brand new.
You know, I didn't have a lot to trade. But what happened was that there are ways to work a committee. I'll give you an example. I knew that the chairman was, I won't call him an alcoholic, but he really was, liked to drink. And
you know exactly what he liked to drink.
Yeah. So what you can't keep liquor on the ground, but you know a lot of people did anyway. But I was trying to relate to the chairman, right? So I went to the chairman. This is about 11 o'clock at night in the committee meeting, and I said, you know what? I sure need to drink. And I've never been a big drinker. You know, I drink my share of beer, but I never been, you know. But I said, oh, you know, I really need a drink. And this guy looks at me like, you know. You know,
me too.
Yeah. You know, he says, why don't you bring it? Well, we'll go up to my office. I said, okay. So, you know, he passes the chair over to the vice chairman, and we go upstairs. Come on, he said, let's go. He's conservative, Democrat. We go up to his office, and this is what I wasn't expecting. This, he has these little foam cups, and he has got some gin, and he pours about a half cup of gin. Which is all right, and he pours himself about a half a cup of gin. And what the next thing is what really caught me off guard was he raises his glass, he says, bottoms up.
Yeah.
I said, okay, you know, bottoms up. half a cup of about four shots. Yeah. So, boy, it just hit me like a button, like a heart attack, cardiac arrest. So he said, how's that? He said, oh man, that was great, thanks. You know, we went down and we were walking down and I said, say, Jack, what do you think about a subcommittee like this on my bill? And he said, I had one conservative, one liberal, and one Mexicano conservative. Okay? I figure I could pull that Mexicano conservative for cross. Okay? He had one liberal, one conservative and one Mexicano conservative, but I figured I could pull that as a subcommittee. So he says, on one thing, he says, why don't we, I can't report that bill out. I mean, you know, when the press, he said, we could be here until about 1 o'clock in the morning, the press will dwindle away, and then, you know, I'll lay it out.